Good afternoon. So last time we talked about iNotes, so this other way of organizing file systems where we decided we would put all the information about a file in essentially one place, except for the name of the file, which we store in the directory pointing to it. So this kept everything together, and in this design of file system, we just have an array of these inodes for all the files we have, and we'd have from our, in our directories just the number in that array to look up. Now, in this scheme, we said we were going to store all the information on the file that includes where its data is. We had a bunch of pointers, but we realized, well, if you want to have these array of inodes, and we want to support very large files, that's not going to be enough. So we have some number of what we call direct pointers, but then we had some indirect pointers, where we said we're going to have a pointer, but not to the actual data for the file, but to more pointers for data for the file. And we figured out that that wasn't enough, because we want files which are bigger than one of those pointers could handle, or even a couple. So we had double indirect pointers, where we had pointers to pointers to pointers, and triple indirect. And you could imagine maybe we'd extend this further if we wanted to support bigger files. And the overall result of this scheme was that, given a file and a location in it, we knew which pointers to look at directly. We didn't have to like go through each one at a time to find it, like we did with the FAT file system, where we had to go through this linked list of what's the next block, and so on. It also meant that we didn't have to store data for all the blocks of the files. We have this idea of sparse files, where we only populate a couple of those pointers that aren't even the first few made. And since with inodes, we just point to a file from our directory with its number, its index in that inode array, we said that we would call these pointers and directories hard links, and with a little bit of work, we were not restricted to having a file just have one name and one directory. We could have multiple hard links to it, and that little bit of extra work is we just need to track how many references there were to each file. We also mentioned this idea of symbolic links, where we wanted sort of a pointer by name to another file. So we'd store basically a special file or a special directory entry that contained the name of something else to look up, rather than the actual number. So after we talked about this inode organization, we talked about some things that it didn't do very well. And one of those things was dealing with locality on disk. We learned that the way hard drives work, we really want to try to keep the data for files and directories all in one place on the disk, but this scheme fundamentally didn't do that. So first of all, it was hard to make sure that when we allocated data blocks for a file, that we have a whole bunch of them in one place on the disk. Also, the metadata for the file, those block pointers and that basic information in the inode, would be at the beginning of the disk in the inode array, and the data for the file might be much further on disk, which is not what we want. So there's this scheme that solved this problem known as block groups. And for block groups, what we did is we just made sort of mini file systems on the disk where we said, the first block of inodes goes to this first chunk, second block goes to the second chunk. Each of those chunks, in addition to having a block of inodes, would have a bunch of data blocks. And when ranking files, our goal would be to choose inodes that were all in the same block for all the files in each directory. So when we're reading from different files in the same directory, they'd be in similar locations on disk. And for each file inode in that block, to try to choose data blocks from the same block, if possible, to try to keep that close on disk. But since we're just dividing up the inodes and the data blocks in these groups, we still had the option of pointing to inodes which were stored in a different group or blocks which were stored in a different group, which is important because, maybe if we have a really big file, it doesn't fit in one block group, or we run out of space, it's not a problem, it's just a little slower because we have to seek more on our disk. Another issue we talked about being a problem was that we had a bunch of block pointers, and those end up taking up a lot of space for a big file. Now, if we want to store hundreds of megabytes files, well, if we have kilobyte blocks, that's hundreds of thousands of block pointers. That's a lot of data just to point to data. And we'd really hope that all that data would be stored in, like, mostly contiguously on the disk anyways. So we have this scheme to take advantage of the fact that hopefully we end up storing the file as just one contiguous set of blocks on disk. And rather than storing pointers to each block, we'd store a list of ranges of blocks. So we'd say the first part of the file's data is blocks 17 through 30, next part of the file's data is like blocks 50 through 1,000, and we'd go through that list to find the data rather than having individual pointers. And for big files, this would be a big savings. For small files, not very helpful. We also mentioned that while we're choosing this block size, that means that if we have really small files, which we learned were actually really common, like really small files are really common in practice, that if they don't take up a whole block, we're going to allocate a whole block for them, and that's going to be very wasteful of space. And we also have this pressure to increase our block size in order to store less block pointers. So we have this compromise that we divide up our blocks into these fragments, but only use that for really small files. So we'd have a block, say, split up into four pieces for storing small files, but for larger files, we'd always use whole blocks, so we wouldn't have to have extra block pointers. Let me mention another problem with both the inode-based file system and FAT was we talked about how our directories worked. And our directories were just these sort of flat arrays of name, pointer to where the file is. That for both FAT and XV6. And if we think of a directory with like 10,000 files, that means if we want to figure out whether a particular file name is in there, we have to scan this big list. That's slow. So we need some way of storing something in a more efficient way on disk. And we talked about, well, we can store a tree data structure on the disk. And a challenge with that is that we can't store it the way we would in memory efficiently because, well, then we have lots of indirection. We have the same kind of problem we had with traversing that linked list in the FAT. And that's going to be bad on the disk because, well, we have to do lots of seeking to read each of the things. And it turns out we have to read like a sector at a time at least. We can't read less than 512 bytes. So if we're reading 512 bytes to get only 4 bytes of it, that's a lot of wasted disk I/O. So our solution was to store non-binary trees, trees where each node would store enough things to fill up a sector. So that way, when we read whole sectors, we'd get the most bang for our buck. But we'd still have a tree data structure, so we wouldn't have to do a search through a giant long list of file names. Okay, so any questions on everything we covered last time, which is a lot. So. Yes?
For files that are so big for block groups, are the if it's part of multiple block groups, are those block groups located close to each other?
Question is, if the file is part of multiple block groups, are they located close to each other? I do not know what FFS, which is the original file system we talked about, does, or what Extended 4 does for this sort of case. There are multiple reasonable choices for this. Like, one notion you could have is that the file is large enough that it doesn't fit in the block group. Probably you're going to need to seek to read it anyways, so maybe it doesn't matter so much where you put it as long as you try to make it contiguous. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so as some of you have noticed, the FAT assignment is out. Some things I'd like to mention, because they're a common source of confusion, even though they're in the hints of the assignment, worth reading. So you're going to need to use the references, because you're not going to be able to look at our slides and create a correct implementation. We didn't tell you some things you might need to know, like how big are FAT entries. You know, you might need to know that. We also kind of glossed over some details. So our slides might give you the impression, hey, cluster zero, that's sector zero. It's not actually the case. That's sometimes the case, but not in any of the example file system images we give you. So just a note, and yes, that's due Friday for the checkpoint, and a week from that for the final submission. So our main topic today is going to be about crashes. So the crash happens on my machine. What's the state of my file system? And so far, we just haven't talked about that issue. So one question is, well, what if I'm writing while a crash happens? What happens to the data I'm writing? So hard drives are actually nice here. Kind of. So hard drives, I mentioned that they do this checksumming. They make sure that each sector has the correct data themselves by storing basically a hash of the data. And since they do this for each sector, this means that we're not ever actually going to get a case where we were writing to a particular sector and like I pull the power and only half the sector is written. The only options are I see the old data, I see the new data, or the hard drive tells me, sorry, you don't have data on that sector anymore. And we're going to take advantage of this, that we have at least some guarantees on, you know, if I pull the power, what happens? And typically, hopefully, the hard drive will finish up writing some whole number of sectors, but not really guaranteed. And there are two big sort of reliability issues we're going to talk about. So the most obvious one is, well, if I pull the power, are my files still there? And that's important. But what file systems are really more concerned about, and what's more of a subtle issue, is whether my file system is in a consistent state. So for example, we really want to make sure we know what blocks are free. Or at least, we want to make sure that we don't think blocks are free that are holding important data. Or else, disaster might happen after we boot up, and we might decide to take advantage of those mistakenly free blocks and erase your data, therefore making the answer that was previously yes, your data is still there, a no. So with this idea in mind, let's look at an example of creating a file in FAT and think about how this plays into what's going to happen with respect to consistency and whether our data is still available. So if we're creating a file in FAT, let's say it takes up three clusters. We're going to allocate three clusters in the file allocation table, set them up to point to each other. Then let's say we have to add a directory entry. So maybe in the worst case, we have to add a new block to the directory. So we write that new block, and we update the file allocation table entries for the directory to point to that extra block and have that new directory entry. So overall, we have these six updates to do. We're going to have to write the FAT entries for the directory, for the file, and we're going to have to write the new cluster for the directory containing the new directory entry that we just appended to the end of it for this file, and we're going to have to actually write the file's data. So this is six clusters we have to write. And a loss of power, only some of them are going to be completed. We know that like at least whole sectors of these are going to be completed or not. So there's an important question we have to answer, which is, well, if these are the updates we have to do, what order should we do these in? So think about that. First, let's look at this question. So let's say only one and two happen. What's that going to do to our file system? I only do the updates of the FAT entries for the directory and the file. So how is that? So I do that, power goes off, I reboot the machine. What's going to happen to my file system? what's going to be wrong? But we didn't do all the writes. Yeah. So we're going to have entries that don't point to anything. Okay. So you're saying, we'll just start with this one. So we have entries that don't point to anything. So what's the consequence of that going to be? So let's think about the entries for the directory. What's that going to mean for the entry, that entry for the directory? Yeah, so for the directory, whatever is in 3 is now in the directory. And we don't know what's there. It was ever was there before. So that's actually pretty bad. So whatever data was in cluster 3, was in the cluster marked with a 3 in a circle, is now part of the directory. And if those look like directory entries, well, now you have some extra files in your directory. So this is an example of a consistency problem, right? Like, we just had directory files in the directory materialize out of nowhere. So what's the consequence for the file pointers from the fat to nowhere? So that's for the file. I allocated some fat entries to eventually store the file. So what's the consequence of those completing? So
your file on disk is going to contain arbitrary data instead of the correct data?
So you're saying the file on disk contains arbitrary data. So I agree, but we have to have a way of accessing that file. And it turns out that because we didn't write its directory entry, we're never going to get there. And since we don't have a way of accessing it, so for file, we have allocated space that can't be accessed. So we just have space that can't be accessed, and since it can't be accessed, we can't delete it. It's just there forever. There's no way to remove a file. It doesn't have a name. It doesn't have a directory entry. But those clusters aren't marked as free. Okay, so how about if everything but, I guess we already talked about, if everything but 3 completes, well, then we're going to end up with a situation where the directory has these extra entries. So that would be another example of the same, kind of case. So that in mind, we have our operations here. What order is best? What order, if a crash happens in the middle, are you going to be least disappointed as a user of this machine? I'll give you a minute to check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what the consequences are. if we did everything about 3, it was this, in the previous example, the problem was that we had the directory, now whatever was previously in 3 is part of the directory, which could be junk directory entries. In the previous slide, you're saying, when did we allocate space? We couldn't access it. When we wrote the file entries in the FAT that allocated the space. And if we didn't have a directory entry for the file also written, that meant we couldn't access it. Like more time? Okay, a couple. Who'd still like more time? Okay, let's see. Who thinks probably A? Probably B? Okay, probably C? Probably D? Probably E? Okay, I do think B and D are better answers than all the others. And I do have a preference between them. But let's see, someone wanted to defend either of those answers. So what are the important things we're doing with either of those? It's like we're solving the biggest problems, the biggest trade-off. Yeah. So you're saying we write the data before we write pointers to it.
Yeah.
So there's two. One thing you're saying, so here, both of these, we write data before pointers. So this prevents, one thing you talked about is that this means we don't have pointers to unallocated things. But I think the most important thing here is that we don't have pointers to data that don't have pointers to have pointers to wrong data. When we write the pointers first, then now they, if we have a crash after we write those pointers, we would have a pointer to data which doesn't make sense. So in both of these solutions, we're avoiding that. So then we have which of these is better? So I would assert that if we aren't writing the FAT entries, it probably doesn't matter which order we write 3 and 4 in, because if we don't have any pointers to them, if we have a crash, all we've done is changed unallocated space in our disk. So the order doesn't matter for those, because all we're doing is changing unallocated space. We can do it all we want. It won't change what the file system thinks is there. As for writing 1 or 2 first, if we write one first here, then this means that at this point, we have a pointer, the directory entry points to an allocated file. And versus here, we have a file that can't be accessed. So both of these aren't great. So the first case, the directory entry points to an unallocated file, but we can detect that. When we try to read that file, we'll look at the fat and we'll say, this is a free space. So we can detect that. But this is problematic because the question is, what if we allocate that space? If we allocate the same blocks? So right after reboot, we'll be able to tell what happened. But if we then write a new file and allocate the same blocks in the fat, we won't know that there's already something there unless we did a bunch of extra effort to check for that. With the file that can't be accessed, well, now we are wasting space on our disk. Waste space on the disk. Forever. So that's not great. My preference is for this. And you might say, why am I okay with wasting space on the disk forever? Well, it's not really forever, really, until we fix it. And we can fix this. I'll talk about that later. But we can't really fix the first case if we accidentally allocate space over the file we already put there. That we can't really fix after the fact. Yes?
So what's
wrong with allocating space over the file that you already put there? So the question is, what's wrong with allocating space over the file? What if we allocate the same blocks? So in this case, we would here, if we allocate the same blocks, yeah, we could have two files at the same location, then, and it would look like we wrote the wrong data to the file before the crash. So the file we created before the crash, it would look like it has the wrong data now. And I argue, you may disagree, that that is a worse outcome than telling you it's not there. And you can reasonably disagree because both of them aren't great, right? Telling you here's a file, but the data for it doesn't make sense versus there's no file with that name whatsoever. They're both not great.
During normal operation on this.
Question is, do I need a fat entry to find a directory?
Yeah, like if you were to come back in and it didn't have one or two, and it just had the directory entry and a file cluster, like, could you still find that?
So we need a directory entry to find the file, and the directory needs to have a fat entry for each of its clusters so we know how many directory entries does the directory have. Because remember, like, the directory could be very big or very small. We need to look at the fat to figure out how many clusters are in this directory. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
There's a backup fat. When does that get updated?
When does that get updated? That's a great question. And that's a tricky question, isn't it? Because if it's inconsistent, what do you do? So probably the ideal thing is you update that along with when you update the fat. Yeah?
Are there implementations of fat where, like, the backup fat is used as, like, a ledger for transaction-based invoice?
The question, is there something where we have a ledger for transactions in FAT. I don't know if that exists for FAT, but it certainly exists for other file systems, and that'll be a topic later today. First, let's extend this to XV6. So same question, but XV6 separates these data structures out a little differently. So we have a free block map, because remember, we separately store whether blocks are free from our block pointers, which are in our inodes. Okay, who would like some more time? Okay, who thinks A, B, C, D, E? Okay, so we have split between C and D. I think neither of them is bad. So in C, we're allocating space for the blocks by marking them as not in use. Then we're putting the data there. Then we're making pointers to them for the file. And then we're doing the same thing for the directory. In C, we're allocating space for both. We're writing the data for both the directory entry and the file itself, and updating the pointers. So I think both are reasonable. So, like, the key insight we had here is that we wanted to make sure we would prefer to waste space by allocating things we don't need rather than have pointers to bad data. And notably, we could also have pointers to bad data if we, like, made a pointer to something that had data in it, but we didn't mark it as not free anymore, because then it could be reused. Now, but you complain here that we're wasting space, we'd like to undo that, and I promised you, well, we're going to have a way of undoing that. So there's a recovery process that we use if we're doing this careful ordering. And this is with programs you may or may not have seen, like fscheck or checkdisk. Fscheck is the Unix Linux one. Checkdisk is the old DOS one. There's probably some different name on Windows these days. And these are things you'd either run manually or periodically, like every so many boots, or after you detect an abnormal shutdown where you suspect a crash happened. And what you do there is you look for things like, is there a file that doesn't have a name but has data allocated? Can I free up that space? And these other inconsistencies. So for example, in an inode-based file system, you know, our order normally is we allocate data block, write the data block, update the free block map, update the inode, update the directory entry, and so on. So we mark things as used before writing pointers to them. And in a recovery procedure, we look for things that are marked as used, but not actually accessible. So the way we can do that is we read every single directory entry, starting at the root. We just go through all the directory entries. We read all the inodes. We figure out, are there any inodes that no directory entry points to? If so, we can get rid of it. We can mark it as free again. Are there any data blocks that no inode or directory, no inode that's pointed to by a directory entry points to? If so, we can free those data blocks up. So this is how we undo it. And we can also deal with like updating access times that we can detect were missed. So this is something that's really done. Now, you might complain, this procedure seems a little bit expensive. Maybe more than a little bit expensive. I think of having, like, you know, a million files on my disk, then we're scanning through a million files, and if I have 100 gigs of data, I'm scanning through block pointers for 100 gigs of stuff to do this procedure. So it's slow. But it does actually fix the inconsistencies, and we don't lose data. In the sense that if the file was written, the data's not going to go away. Because we were careful about making sure we marked things as allocated and so on. We do lose data in the sense that if you're in the middle of writing something while a crash happens, well, maybe it won't be written. Okay, so questions on this idea? So let's give a concrete example of this. So let's think about, we're unlinking a file. So we overwrite the directory entry for the file to remove it. But there's another hard link to the file, so we don't remove it. So first of all, what order should we do these two modifications in? So first, we have to overwrite the directory entry. Secondly, there's a link count in the inode we have to decrement. What order do we do them in? It's the best order. One first or two first? So the idea is I have like slash foo that points to this file, this inode, and another slash bar that points to it, and I'm removing slash foo. And we have the num pointers is going from 2 to 1. So those are the two updates. Yes?
Probably remove. I'd say decrement the link count, because if you're unlinking them, that means the foo won't point to the inode anyway. So that even if the directory entry doesn't get overridden successfully, it won't matter. While it matters for the inode itself later on.
So you want to unlink first. You're saying that if the directory entry gets overwritten later, it won't matter. So the question is, why are we overwriting the directory entry? And I perhaps wasn't clear about that. Overwrite the directory entry for the file with an unused one. That's the intention here. So we're overwriting it to remove it from the directory. Does that change your answer? Or yeah. Different answer? Decrement the link count first?
Yeah.
So you have a different opinion?
If you decrement the link first and then you crash, then if you try to delete it again, you could decrement the link so it goes down to 0 when there's still something else pointing to it.
Yeah, so the problem is if we decrement the link count, then after our crash, we're going to have number of pointers is 1, but we're still going to have this link here, right? This directory entry pointing to the inode. If we crash immediately after that. And then if we say, oh, that didn't happen before I crashed, let me do it again. Now I'm going to actually get rid of this, decrement the number of pointers to 0, and get rid of the inode because, hey, there's no pointers to it. We're done. Yeah, your question?
Could we not just look at it and, like, when we realized there was a crash and gave it off, and that we can say, hey, there are two pointers to this, and update that back to the pointer?
So question is, could we just update the pointer count? Yes, so a valid solution is you say, we're always going to do this procedure and count the number of pointers to every single inode by scanning all the directory entries and update. That is a valid solution. But this means that we have to make sure we're guaranteed to run this after the crash. But if we can do that, yes, then it doesn't matter. So our two options are, and we just got to like what a recovery operation is. So, you know, probably better to do two, to do one, then two. So count, link count doesn't become zero. Be zero with no link later. Recovery operation is just recount the number of links by scanning all directory entries. And your observation is, if we always did this, the order wouldn't matter. But that depends on us knowing to always do it. Okay, so questions about? Yeah.
So systems don't do this automatically when they crash?
So question is, systems don't do this automatically, so they try. You have to detect that you crashed, which a typical way of doing is when you're writing to your disk, you write something special to the header to say that we haven't finished up. When you undo it, you don't. A concern is that maybe there are ways other than just like losing power where writes might not happen. But systems do try to do this to avoid issues. Okay. So, talked about FS check. So, and sorts of things we can do, and I guess I'll skip over the exercise of what if the link count becomes zero, then we want to, you know, do our ordering so that we get rid of pointers to file, and our recovery operation is going to probably handle finishing deletion of freeing the blocks up, which we want to do last. So this is probably we want to do, you know, do this last to not point to invalid data later on. So talking about FS check. So FS check, it does a whole lot of these recovery things of like counting the number of links and so on. Yeah, but it's really slow. So I can give a concrete example. My desktop, it has to scan through 2.4 million inodes and 379 million blocks. Pointers, block pointers. So that's slow. But it is done automatically. Now, this seems like a nice solution to reliability, except for how bad recovery is. But maybe if we don't crash very often, that's not a big deal. But there is a big hidden cost, or not really hidden, but big cost to this ordering. And remember when we talked about disk scheduling, we really wanted to order our writes based on the locations of things on disk. And I've just told you, we're not doing that. We're being careful about our ordering to avoid data corruption, just in case we come up and don't do this recovery, or when we do the recovery, we can make sure that we don't get confused about having files that where we don't know what the data is. And ordering constraints make this hard, because the ordering says, if we have to write the free block map, then the blocks, then the inode, then the directory, well, we have to seek bunch. Sorry, it's just how it works. So we're going to talk about a solution where we're going to do something better than ordering to ensure consistency. And the notion I'm going to take is that I told you that when we write a sector that's atomic, it happens or it doesn't because of that checksum the disk is doing. And we really like the entire operation of like creating a new file or removing a link to a file to happen in this way. So can we do that? Sure. We just need to make sure when we do the update that we only write one sector to do it. Well, we can't directly do that, but we'll make it so there's one sector which is sort of the key. So we'll have a bunch of updates, which we'll call a transaction, happen all at once, and there will be one single sector disk update which will make it happen. And if that doesn't happen, none of the operations will happen. So we're going to design our file system so there's going to be one disk write we do where a whole bunch of things all over the disk will conceptually happen, and if we don't do it, they won't. And the way we're going to achieve this is by keeping a log. So, in our, and this is something the XV6 file system does. I told you it had a log. So let's talk about what something you might put in that log. So let's say we're writing a file. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to write to the log the transaction I want to do. I'm not going to actually change things on disk. I'm just going to say, I intend later on to modify a data block here and a data block here. So I just write down, that's what I'm modifying. Let's say the data block for the directory here and the data block for the file here, and the inode for the file here, or the directory, and also the free block map, and so on. So I just write down, these are the things I intend to do later on. And then I'm going to do my one update, which says that this operation is complete. I'm going to write a commit message saying, yes, these are definitely happening. You might say, well, we didn't do them, so how is this going to work? So the file system is going to have to do a little extra work to make sure that this one single update where we wrote commit actually makes sure the update happens. And so the file system is going to be responsible for ensuring that if we wrote this commit to this log, that the updates will definitely happen. And our mechanism is that when we boot up, we're going to do a recovery procedure, which is going to be, we're going to read the log, and we're going to redo everything that's written down here. Now, typically, they'll have already been done. But that's OK. We can write the same data to a block twice. Not a big deal. So we're just in case we're redoing them. And this scheme is known as redo logging. It's called redo logging because we write a log of what we want to do, and we redo it if there's a problem. Yes?
What happens if the what we're trying to write is larger than the log?
So what happens if what we're trying to write is larger than the log? For this scheme, that is a problem. And you'd have to do something like make it more than one transaction. Or like have a way of like having the log be in multiple pieces. So questions? This? Yeah.
So you probably wouldn't want to do this on like an SSD or something?
Question is, you probably wouldn't want to do this on SSD. This is perfectly fine to do on an SSD. It is extra writing. Yes. And that is a concern. But because the benefits of the recovery procedure being so much more efficient are so good, you probably are okay with that. Also, as we'll probably talk about in a bit, there's ways that file systems make this cost less bad at the cost of making the reliability not so great. So, yeah, and we can continue doing more transactions. Now, I've written to the log that I committed to doing this operation. That's all I need to do. And if I have a power failure, that's going to happen. Doesn't matter that I didn't actually bother seeking to this part of the disk yet. It's done. So that's great for the file system, and it's great for not making our writing to the disk expensive. We don't actually need to write that data until it's convenient to do so, which means we don't have to seek all over the place. So we can just do a whole bunch of operations, and sometime later, when it's convenient, we'll actually apply those to disk. And once we've applied all the operations in a transaction to disk, we can overwrite the log, and this is how we eventually don't run out of space in our log. So once we know everything in the log has been put on disk, all the intended operations are actually done, we can just overwrite those log entries and get rid of them, and probably put new log entries in their place. Questions about procedure? Yeah.
So what you just said is basically any time it reads that like that commit has gone through, it'll just clear it out of the log then? Or like, it is able to be overwritten in the log?
So anytime we realize that all the things that are in the transaction are all actually done, it can clear it out of the log.
Oh, okay. Is that different from like seeing that commit message?
So the commit message tells us it's conceptually done, okay, that we promise it's going to actually happen. Mm-hmm. But we have to keep in the log just in case until it actually has happened. Otherwise we might get rid of our only copy of the information.
Okay.
So our overall procedure here is for file creation is we write our steps to the transaction, then we write commit transaction to the log, and then we do the updates. And after we've done all the updates, we reclaim that space in the log so we don't keep two copies of things around forever. And if we have a crash any time before you write that commit, then we just ignore that part of the log. We just say there's no commit, don't care. File wasn't created. We don't have to worry about wasted space. There's no wasted space. We just don't have the file being created at all. If the commit happens and we have a crash while we're doing the updates, well, we redo the updates to make sure they actually happen. So we handle both cases where either the file is fully created with all of its stuff, or it's not. We don't have any halfway states where like we have a file allocated but no pointer to it. It's either there or it isn't, even though we had to modify lots of places on disk to do this operation. And like there's the other half of this, which is that when we boot up, we're going to have to read the log and look for every operation with a commit and do it again. And note that we're kind of ignoring whether it was done already. So we're just going to like do things twice sometimes. That's OK. Some questions? Yeah?
So there's never really going to be a case where a log is going to get written over on a false commit. There isn't such a thing.
What do you mean a false commit?
Like, it would say the commit was finished when it actually wasn't. That's
so the question is, are we ever going to reclaim space when it hasn't actually been the case that all the updates have happened? Hopefully not. If we do, that's a bug. That would probably be a really nasty bug to debug. Like, really horrible, because like sometimes when you cut power, you lose data. But hopefully we avoid that. Yeah.
Can you explain why you can't have like created an inode and then the power go off and then like have no intermediate state in between?
So why we don't have like partially done things?
Yeah.
So in the case where we have a crash before the commit happens, we haven't actually changed any of these parts on disk. And on boot, we're just going to read this log and say, oh, didn't find a commit for this begin. So I just ignore it.
So what if you got halfway through committing it and the power went
on? Okay, so the question is, what if I got halfway through committing it? So we're relying on this property, that updating a sector is atomic. So our commit's going to be one sector. Either that sector is there, and we read it, or it isn't. And that's how we determine whether it committed. And indeed, if we don't have that, that would be a problem. Yes?
So the ones with no commit, don't you want to redo the process from begin again?
So the question is the ones with no commit. So the issue is that if we don't have a commit, we don't know whether like we got cut off like here. So we don't know how to complete the operation.
So can
So our preference is going to be to say it just didn't happen rather than getting some inconsistent state. Even though maybe like if you were doing data recovery, like let's say like I lost power, there's this file I was just editing, where is it? Yes, maybe you look for this, but as an operating system, we're just going to say, sorry, you didn't do it in time. Other questions? Okay. So a subtlety with this is because we redo operations on recovery, we need to make sure it's okay to do all our logged operations twice. And this means we need to be careful about what we want to write to our log. So we could write, say, set the link count to 4. That's a good thing to write to our log, because if we keep doing that, well, the data is going to be the same. A bad thing to write would be increment the link count. If we do that over multiple times, we have a problem. So, and we're going to write like overwrite inode number x with a new value, not like allocate a new inode, because if we overwrite the inode multiple times, we'll get the same result. If we allocate a new inode multiple times, that's going to be different each time. So this is known as idempotency, that if we keep doing it, nothing changes. So that's our redo login. So write the intended operations before we touch the real data. Write this commit larker, which has to be an atomic write, that it's either there or it isn't, and then update the real data. And because we wrote the commit marker, we know that on boot, we're going to check for those and redo those operations just in case we got interrupted in the middle of this update the real data process. Questions? Yeah?
The write to the log atomic.
So the question is the write to the log. These writes do not have to be atomic. The writes of the intended operation don't have to be atomic. The write of the commit has to be. And it has to be, we have to make sure the write to the commit happens after the write of the rest of the log. So we have an ordering constraint there. But that's not a big performance concern because we can make the log contiguous on disk.
So that's where you would lose data if you didn't write to the log and it just happened to turn off when you're writing to the log.
So question is, we lose data? We lose data if it turns off any time before we write this commit marker, and we have to write the commit marker after we do write everything to the log. Okay. So this redo logging technique is very popular in file systems since the 90s. You'd think it would have come up earlier because redo logging is actually really old, like the 60s old, 50s, 60s at least. But didn't come to file systems until like the 90s and consumer file systems often later. But file systems which do this are often called journaling file systems. And XV6, in fact, has one of these. Now XV6 has something which maybe is a log, but might not really look like one. So the XV6 log holds one transaction. If you want to do two transactions, you do one, you do all the writes for it, then you reclaim that space. And XV6 doesn't have actually a commit marker that's written out here. What they do is they have a header for the log, and that's one sector. In that top beginning of that sector, there's a number of blocks number, and if it's 0, it's not committed. And if it's something else, or non-zero, if it's 0, it's not committed. And if it's non-zero, it is committed, and you have to redo it. And they make sure that this header is always the last thing written when we do a transaction. So if we're doing a transaction, first, we clear the header to say, we're in the middle of something. So we say, there's no active thing right now. So we set the number of blocks to 0. Then, we write the data that we want to have written. And the format of every entry in the XV6 log is just, to this block, write this data. So they don't say, update inode at this. They just say, overwrite this part of the inode array with this data. So they write all the data that changed. Then they write the log header. And they write down, OK, this is the data which changed. Where does it go? So in the log header, in that one sector, is where does the data go and how many blocks are there? And the idea is, on boot, XV6 looks at this and says, is the number of blocks not zero? If so, I'm just going to go through that list, do all those writes, and then clear it. So this is the part which would be redundant recovery, or you do normally. So you write the data based on the location specified in the log. And when that's done, you clear the log header and start your next transaction. This is how XV6 does it. So you can see it's the log system, except the log holds only one transaction. And we kind of put the beginning commit in one place. Questions? Yeah.
Would you only really need to change the number of blocks to zero? You don't have to change the location again.
The question is, I don't have to change the location again. So this whole thing, log header, is one sector. So we have to actually write the whole thing at once. But the only thing we're checking at boot is the number of blocks. So that's all that matters. But we can't avoid writing the rest. Okay. Other questions? So that's what XV6 does. And one thing that we kind of glossed over is I gave you the impression that we just write each single file update as a separate transaction. This is not actually what most real file systems do, including XV6. That if we have lots of things we're doing on the disk at the same time, we can put all of them together into one transaction. And this is faster. This is one long write to finish up everything. We don't have to do lots of little writes. And we don't wait to write. We just put things together. And this is what XV6 does. So XV6 combines all the updates that are happening into one transaction. And they only does the committing when either they run inside of room in the log, so it has to actually write stuff to disk, or there's nothing happening, so it might as well write to disk. And real file systems use similar strategies, that they want to have lots of things together. And this means that this journaling is often way, way faster than that careful ordering. Because we combine, getting the data to the disk, we just do lots of writes for everything we're doing in one place in the log, and that's it. And we write the real data later on. But we do that in a way which really minimizes the seeks at our convenience. So non-intuitively, even though we're writing everything twice, this is often a big performance win. Okay, so questions? Yes. So I guess I should say writing everything twice. Yeah. So even though we're writing everything twice, you know, we can write the entire log sequentially and do the updates in real order. So it's often way better for performance. To give a concrete example of that, let's say we're updating 1,000 files. With redo logging, we essentially have two big seeks, one to write the log and one to actually write the data for those files wherever they are on disk. Whereas if we're doing careful ordering, we have a whole bunch of seeks because we have to seek in the middle to update the inode and the data separately. So it often ends up that even though we're writing everything twice, that redo logging makes everything a lot faster. Okay, so questions? Okay, so I talked about redo logging where we put everything in the log. And one complaint you had is, well, what if the log isn't that big? You know, what if we want to keep it small? And we also tell you, like, we're writing everything twice. I said sometimes that's a win. Sometimes it's not going to be a win, of course. If you're writing big files, writing lots of data, like if we're writing 200 gigs instead of 100 gigs, of course it's going to be slower. And so many file systems make some compromises. So some journaling file systems only use journaling for metadata. They just say, data? We'll just write it whenever. We don't care about your data, but we do care about like not having files that point to nowhere and having the same blocks allocated to two files and things like that. So it's common to see journaling file systems which don't actually use the journaling mechanism for updates to the file data. They let that be less consistent, but they at least make sure that they keep their free file map consistent. And this is just for performance. I don't think this is a good idea, but apparently enough file system authors have, and it is really common. Yeah?
This is a little bit unrelated. How do partitions work into all of this?
A partition basically means that that the OS treats a subset of the sectors of the disk as one disk. So that's on journaling. Any questions on journaling before we go on to our sort of little extra topic? Okay. So something that came up earlier is I mentioned the FAT stores multiple copies of the file allocation table and header. And most iNode-based file systems do something similar. They have multiple copies of the super blocks, the file system header for iNode-based file systems. And the notion is that if part of the disk is lost, we still have a copy of this really important data structure, so maybe we can recover some files. Whereas if that part of the disk was lost otherwise, it would be really hard to read anything. And there's an extension to this you can imagine, which is why am I just keeping multiple copies of the file allocation table? Let's just keep two disks. Let's just write everything to two disks. And when we can read from either. This is even faster, because we can read two different things from both disks. So this is a real thing people do, mirroring. So it makes your reads faster, and it's a simple solution to redundancy. Like, this is how you deal with, what about the data loss? Previously, with journaling, we were just dealing with inconsistency. But we still, if the disk went bad, too bad. Now you might say, this seems a little wasteful. And sometimes that's true. Sometimes you might say, you know, I want to store 10 disks worth of data. Why should I buy 20 disks for that? So there are compromises. So here with mirroring, we're saying with 10 disks worth of data, we're going to store 20 disks worth, and we're going to handle losing. And we can handle this, and you can lose 10 of them, up at most 10 of them. You might say, OK, that seems kind of useful. But there's extensions to this which can give us other sort of design points. So one example is if I have 10 disks worth of data, let's say I have 15 disks I bought. What's the best I can do? Well, the best possible, like mathematically, is like there's nothing possibly better than making it so I could lose any five of those disks and still have my data. Like, that's the best possible I could do. And it turns out that there are real schemes, and I do mean any five disks, which is unlike mirroring. There are real schemes where you can say, I have my 10 disk worth of data. I'm going to store data on 15 disks so that if I lose any five, I'm OK. And these schemes use math, of course. Math you learn in 34, if you want to take that course, based on what are known as erasure codes. Basically, we encode the data in such a way we can recover it if certain parts are missing. So sort of a simple example of this is that if we have two disks of data to store on three disks, we went away where we can recompute the original two disks from any of two of the three. So a scheme for doing this is we store the original data on two of the disks, and on the third disk, we store the bitwise OR of that, bitwise XOR. And from this, we can actually use bit XOR to recover any of the others. And we can extend this to handle actually like arbitrarily like if I have any x of k of n schemes, and there's a whole bunch of schemes like this, the most common set of them is known as RAID, for redundant array of independent disks. And these are sort of extensions of mirroring, but we can be more clever than just storing a whole copy of the data, so we can get, like, make a compromise between how much data can we handle losing and how much space we use. So, questions about this idea? Okay. So that's handling sort of what if my disk goes bad. And I guess in my last 5 minutes, I'm going to talk about briefly about another file system feature for handling the more common type of my data going away. So if you talk to like a system administrator at, say, a university, their most common type of data went away is someone accidentally deleted it. So there's a really neat file system solution for that known as snapshots. And the idea is the file system keeps old versions of file around. It keeps just multiple versions of every file. In fact, it keeps multiple versions of the entire file system. So in accident deletion, you just go back to the old version, and you just keep a certain number of old versions. That's enough that hopefully when someone comes to you as a sysadmin, you can say, nope, we still got it. And the implementation mechanism for this is copy on write. That rather than actually allocating space in the same, writing the file in the same place, whenever we overwrite part of a file or write a new file, we just allocate new blocks for it and point to the copies. And we keep a copy of the old inode somewhere in our snapshot to point to the old version. And if we run out of space, we just start deleting the snapshot versions to make sure we can still keep storing files. And this means we can share the common parts between versions. Some questions on this little idea? So a way of looking at this is, let's say I have an inode here with direct and indirect blocks. When I update it in this style of file system, I'm going to make a new inode. So I'm going to make a copy on write of the inode and do copy on write for those block pointers. So I'm going to just have an extra copy of the data that changed here and the pointers to it. So I have an old inode and a new inode. And the idea is that the old inode is going to be in my snapshots, and the new inode is going to be the current version. Yeah?
How does this work with the table of free and available block pointers?
How does this work with the table of free and available block pointers? It makes it a lot more complicated. I don't actually know the details of what the most common implementation of this does. But if you want to look it up, it's CFS is a common file system which does this, well, most publicly well-known. So you might say, if I have two versions of the inode, doesn't that mean I have to change all my inode numbers? So in ZFS, they have a solution for this where they split the inode array into pieces, and they have indirection for that. And the idea is when you want to allocate a new inode, you update the pointers to it. So you only update a pointer to it and a pointer to that and that part of the array, rather than updating the whole array. And this means that you still share most of the inodes that don't change, so you don't have to like make a copy of the whole inode array, but you also don't like have to update all the inode numbers between the snapshot and not. So this is our that. And for storing snapshots, you just have an array of these roots inodes. So each one is a snapshot, and you update snapshots separately. So this is the idea of snapshotting. You have an array of versions of your file system, and you use indirection, so you only copy, change, you only modify the parts that change. You just have pointers to the same thing for the parts which don't. To make this practical, we split up the inode array so we don't have to like overwrite the whole inode map or change all the inode numbers. And ZFS is probably the biggest example of a file system that supports this. And if it's turned on, you like CD to a directory. There are the files as of that date, assuming that they were kept around. And I think I'm out of time, so next time we'll talk about distributed systems.